When Iowa was open to settlement, men from all over the world came here to work the land. With them came women, who also rose at dawn or before and worked hard all day long. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about the roles of women on the farm in history, in literature, in pop culture, and in the present. I'll talk with Zachary Michael Jack. He's the author most recently of The Midwest Farmer's Daughter, In Search of an American Icon. I'll also talk with two women who have firsthand knowledge of working on farms, Cheryl Tevis of Iowa Women in Agriculture and Denise O'Brien, founder of the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Even though farming was long considered to be the work of men, as long as there have been farms, there have been women living, working, and growing up on those farms. This hour, we're going to talk about the many roles of women on the farm in history, in literature, in pop culture, and in the present. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Cheryl Tevis of Iowa Women in Agriculture and Denise O'Brien, founder of the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network. But my first guest today is Zachary Michael Jack. He is the author most recently of The Midwest Farmer's Daughter, In Search of an American Icon. He's also part of the seventh generation of his family to farm in Iowa, and he's also an associate professor of English at North Central College in Naperville, Illinois. Hello, Zachary.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
You bet. I should tell you that I had a nightmare last night about this interview, so I was up tossing and turning.
All right. Well, we'll see if this is a dream come true hour. Well, I'm curious about what sent you in this direction. What made you want to research the history of women on Iowa farms?
Boy, there's lots of answers to that. I'd say that one is the point that we reach in our families where a generation is passing, and you have the honor and the privilege and also the responsibility of sorting through, you know, old documents and trying to make sure that those don't get inadvertently thrown away. And what you find there often surprises you in the way of old journals and diaries and old family letters, you know, things that your grandparents had kept, you know, in a back room in an attic for years and years and years because they lived it. They could kind of take it for granted, and the next generation sort of stumbles upon them. And I ran into some old letters from, you know, one of our ancestors, Sally Pickard, who was involved in settling our heritage farm in 1855, and letters from her relatives in New York who were mourning her loss. You know, they were farmers out in the Waterton, Syracuse area, and Sally married Levi, and they left for Iowa around 1854, and the letters are just heartbreaking. I mean, they're missing her. They're wanting her to come back. They're even offering Levi money, you know, to return with her.
Bribing.
Yeah, essentially. And it really makes you appreciate just how much of a risk the pioneers took, you know, husband and wife and kids and often, you know, in-laws in addition.
You also write that in your family lore, and you obviously paid a lot of attention to that family lore and that family history, it was the men who were talked about. You knew the names of your grandfather and your great-grandfather and your great-great-grandfather,
yeah,
et cetera, but you didn't know about the women going back through that
time. That's right. I mean, one of the revealing moments in the lead-up to this book was, you know, looking at an old family history that I think Sally had actually prepared. And, you know, her name wasn't mentioned. It was Mrs. Levi Pickard, which, you know, as all of us know who grew up in Iowa farm families, that's pretty typical, you know, up through really the 60s, 70s, even 80s. I remember my grandmother getting lots of mail that was addressed to, you know, Mrs. Edward Jack. And she didn't bat an eyelash at it. But when you stop to think about it, it is sort of maybe representative of a larger kind of omission in history or neglect of history that we just sort of took for granted for many, many, many years and generations.
There is a photo in the front of your book that I think is just a remarkable picture. And it was taken, I believe, in 1920, around 1920. And it shows your great-grandmother, your great-great-grandmother, and your great-great-great-grandmother.
Yeah.
all in one photo.
That's right. My great-grandmother holding my grandpa, Edward, as a baby. And you can see the, you know, I think that all of our, many of our Iowa families have such a photo where the planets aligned and the stars aligned, and somehow someone had the prescience to take a photo with, you know, four generations together. And when you stumble upon one of these, you know, four or five generations later, it just arrests you. I mean, it literally stops you in your tracks, and it makes crystal clear, you know, the kind of accident of our family. You know, the Romans called it our family genius. And they actually, you know, had little temples in Roman houses to the genius. And they were, the genius was a kind of god that symbolized the family's ability to survive and to live and to thrive against all odds. And this is one of those photos, you know, for me.
Well, so far we've talked about farm wives. And there's a big difference between a farm wife and a farm daughter. But you chose to really focus in your research and in your writing on women who grew up on farms. Why did you want to focus on those women?
You know, I think in some ways it was a follow-up to, I had done a book a few years ago about Uncle Henry Wallace, you know, who's sort of legendary in Iowa and throughout the Midwest as the founder of Wallace's Farmer. He wrote in the, you know, around 1900, lots and lots of famous pieces about farm boys. And, you know, with the idea that if you were writing to and about farm kids, you were in some ways affecting the next generation on the farm in ways that you might not be able to if you're writing to and about middle-aged farm folks and parents. And I think, you know, not a lot was written about farm daughters or farm girls. And many farm women, even in the 1890s, 1900s, 1910s, were indignant about this and would write into the Iowa Homestead and other newspapers pointing out that omission. But for me, to focus on you know, being a farm kid is what I know. And I think that the potential to impact the future is much greater when one, you know, really writes about the kind of younger generation.
When we think about farm boys, of course, those boys were considered to be the future of the farm, and not as much today, clearly, but that has been the traditional way of things. You know, the son would inherit the farm, the son would work alongside with his father often, mm-hmm. or buy a farm nearby and continue that tradition. When you look at expectations for girls on farms, though, what did you find?
Well, I think oftentimes the expectations for girls have been different, sometimes at the great frustration of the girls. Many of the interviewees, I interviewed, you know, dozens upon dozens of farm women, farm daughters, farm granddaughters for this book. And many of them who came of age in the 1960s and 1970s, you know, who are now experiencing the sort of renaissance in women farmers, kind of look back with incredulity that they weren't more involved, or that they weren't asked to be more involved, or that they weren't asked to chore, or that they didn't see themselves as having an ownership role, a stake, you know, being a stakeholder in the farm. Because in many cases, one of my interviewees was the outgoing director of the Midwest Farmland Trust, or the American Farmland Trust Midwest office. And she remembers that her husband actually, she taught him how to drive a tractor, even though her husband was the one who was ultimately the business partner, you know, in a limited corporation with her dad. But she was the one to teach him. So it's sort of, I think there's a generation looking back now thinking, what would have been, you know, had I stepped into the role of being a primary operator of my family farm?
But I think about those girls growing up, and, you know, even when I grew up, which was not that so very long ago, there was really just no expectation that girls mm-hmm. could grow up to take over the family farm. There was no role for girls on the family farm once they had graduated from high school.
I think too often, you know, that's been the case, and I think that's, you know, largely the case in my family, although I think my family's different in some ways. But you know, it's unfortunate, but it is sort of a fact of, you know, agrarian history at this point. And we should say that not all farm families were like that. You know, many farm dads and farm moms really invested in their daughters as potential managers, at least, if not operators of the farm. But too often that wasn't the case.
Well, I think about the women in that picture that you have with your great-grandmothers and great-great and great-great-great. And I think about what those women would have had to do prior to 1920. And the work that they would have had to do on the farm was all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but it would have been primarily in the house and in the kitchen garden.
You know, for the most part, yes, although there's lots of agricultural research that, you know, really shows the degree to which farm women from the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s were bringing in a fair amount of what was then called egg money. They were doing poultry, you know, in the farmyard. They were helping farm, and they were doing a group of tasks that was remarkably more diverse and more labor intensive than generally farm women of the 60s, 70s, 80s did. So in many ways, they're, I would argue, more of a model for the full kind of range and breadth of what farm women have contributed than those later generations, where oftentimes, you know, and this happened in broader American culture, where women in the 1950s and 1960s were, if you know, in popular culture and adverts, if you didn't have to use your hands, if you could, you know, free your hands from those dishwater hands, if you could let appliances do the work, you were sort of among the winners. And earlier farm women knew differently.
When you looked into some of these family remembrances and talked to women about growing up on the farms after the electric stove and a few things made life a lot easier for, you know, the washing machine, that was a huge step forward for women everywhere. But as these girls were growing up in, let's say, the 50s and 60s, what were they being taught to do on the farm?
Well, it's a really good question. You know, I interviewed my mom and my aunts for this book in part as a gesture of sort of, you know, humility in the fact that I realized I didn't really know how they grew up. I just assumed I knew. And, you know, they really didn't have what we would typically call, you know, chore responsibilities. In fact, my mom made a point of, you know, mentioning that my grandma, her mother-in-law didn't really do much outdoor work, you know, although my grandmother contributed immensely in other ways. But I think sometimes in my generation, we have these romantic notions of the way farm partnerships worked. But in the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s, oftentimes it was viewed by many farm men and traditional farmers that to have your daughter out working the fields, getting her hands dirty, was a mark against you, you know, that you should strive to have a kind of operation where you didn't where she didn't have to do those things.
Right. I'm talking with Zachary Michael Jack. His most recent book is The Midwest Farmer's Daughter, In Search of an American Icon. We'll continue our conversation about the many roles that women have filled on farms through history and now in the present in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about the many roles that women have filled on the farm through history. We're talking about farm wives, farm daughters, and later in the hour, I'll be talking with two women who know that life firsthand. I'll talk with Cheryl Tevis of Iowa Women in Agriculture and Denise O'Brien, founder of the Women Food and Agriculture Network. We'd love to hear your stories as well. If you are a woman who grew up on a farm, we'd love to hear about your experience. If you are a woman farmer today, we'd love to hear about your experience. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me right now is Zachary Michael Jack. He's the author of The Midwest Farmer's Daughter, In Search of an American Icon. And Zachary, in the book, you not only talk about history and personal experience and gathering these oral histories that you did, but you also write quite a bit about the archetype of the farmer's daughter. Mm-hmm. And while you were saying just before the break that there were farmers who felt like it was a failure if they had to make their daughters go out and do some of the really hard, dirty work on the farm, there was also this ideal of what a farm girl was. And how did you explore that archetype?
A lot of it was through, you know, all these interviews that I did. But in terms of going back in history, you know, I was just able to turn up some fascinating newspaper articles and magazine articles. And really the fascination with the farm daughter, you know, goes all the way back. I mean, it could even go back to classical times, to Virgil, for example, but and certainly to Britain. But I think it spikes around the Industrial Revolution, you know, not surprisingly. Because as we sort of lost our agrarian moorings in America and Britain in particular, we became more and more – we romanticized, you know, with poetical imaginations what it meant to grow up on a farm. And farmers' daughters in particular, I guess because there's some sexism involved in this too, were portrayed as, you know, there's some articles in here from the 1860s and 1870s from New York, you know, mentioning that men should beware that farmers' daughters were so, you know, alluring that they were bewitching, and you know, a gentleman traveling through the countryside should really look the other way in case lest he be drawn in, you know, to these beautiful farmers' daughters. And of course, that notion of, you know, beauty and maybe purity in some ways, and earnestness and sincerity carries all the way through, you know, to the Midwest Farmer's Daughter line from the Beach Boys song, and then from the Van Halen version of that that came up in the 1980s. So it's a longstanding stereotype and archetype.
And we still retain quite a lot of that in Iowa. I mean, you were writing about some things that have gone by the wayside, and I'm not going to be able to remember the names of the different contests. There was one that was based in Cedar Rapids for, mm-hmm. you know, farmers' daughters, but you know, we still have the State Fair Queen, mm-hmm. and things like that do continue. We do seem to continue this thread.
I think so. I you know, certainly the Iowa's favorite farmers' daughter contest that used to be done by WMT, you know, that sort of started to fizzle out along with a lot of these kinds of competitions in the early 1980s when, you know, culture really sort of changed. And the remnants, the kind of vestigial remnants of that can still be seen at state fairs and so on. But I would argue that they've now have kind of a sort of postmodern, a little bit of an ironic feel, some of those competitions where they used to be. There was no sort of irony about them. They were earnest, and it was a great honor to be declared a plowing queen. You know, one of the artifacts we have in my family, my grandfather Edward won second in the National Clean Plowing Contest in 1947, and there's a great image of him being handed the trophy by a woman from Bennett, Iowa, with Iowa Senator Hickenlooper right there, you know, at his side. So, we still have these competitions, but they're kind of greatly reduced and sort of different than they were.
In the 1960s, of course, many, many things changed in our world, but it was interesting to read some of the personal accounts that you had of women who grew up during that time talking about 4-H and mm-hmm. how they were so frustrated with 4-H because they didn't want to sew and they mm-hmm. didn't want to cook and enter the baking competitions and things like that. And it struck me that in sort of mourning the passing of so much of life on the farm, I mean, the women's revolution really gave women who grew up on farms so many more options that the option of growing up to be a farm wife really seemed so much less attractive to a lot of them.
Yeah, I think you put it really well there, Charity. That's exactly what a lot of my interviewees sort of reported, that, you know, my mom's a good example, born 1950, coming of age in the mid-1960s. And she sort of reports, and I think this is probably true of both boys and girls on the farm, but, you know, around about that age of 12 or 13 or 14, what she used to think was really cool, you know, getting to grow up on a farm, suddenly became sort of not so cool. And she felt like her friends in town were having more fun. They were more sophisticated. They were getting to do things that she wasn't. You know, my aunts kind of reported the same thing. And for all the great goods of the sexual revolution, it created such a dizzying array of opportunities that it was very easy to look at the farm as a life on the farm as being sort of passé or sort of an outgrowth of a patriarchy that many women were eager to jettison in that era. And A lot of the interviewees who left the farm, women who left the farm in the era that I interviewed for this book, sort of expressed some regret, you know, about that maybe they didn't fully understand the choice that they were making, and they were sort of following the mass media approach on this without maybe having the full kind of all the information, you know?
Well, there was another great shift in culture, of course, during that time, and that is that, you know, women were not being raised to graduate from high school and become wives anymore. And it mm-hmm. didn't matter if they lived in town or they lived on the farm. I mean, the idea that women would get married immediately following high school was starting to go by the wayside, or would go off to college in search of a husband and really very little else. That was starting to disappear. And really, as we talked about earlier, you know, the role that girls were being prepared for on the farm was to be the wife of a farmer. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me that shift is what made a lot of this family farm structure and the legacy start to crumble.
It really did. That and the divorce rates. You know, the divorce rates doubled between 1965 and 1975. And, you know, lots of people who know about farm life will tell you that it's a hard thing to do without a partner of some kind. Just the sheer workload, just the amount of stress. And so if one doesn't have that partner, if one's lost that partner, it becomes daunting to the point of feeling at times, you know, impossible. So, yeah, changing, you know, marital institutions, changing standards for our mates, you know, the increase in folks going to college was, you know, certainly wonderful in many ways culturally, but it did mean that lots of farm boys and farm girls went off to school and ended up, you know, marrying someone who was going to lead a very different lifestyle than their parents did and was going to take them off the farm. And this happened to both men and women, you know, in the 1960s, 70s, and even quickened in the 80s and 90s.
We're talking about the roles of women on the farm and how things have changed. And we'd love to hear from you as well. We'd love to hear your personal experiences at 866-780-9100. Shirley is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Shirley.
Hi.
Hi.
I was born in the mid-50s and grew up on dairy farms. My earliest memory of our milking business was it was all done by hand. And it was a very small operation, and out of my father was very much a sexist. I mean, his preference was that the women do the housework, but out of necessity, my mother had to work alongside him milking the cows you know, as I said, the milking was done by hand, and I remember the milk having to be stored in these large milk cans. And it was a rental farm, and my father's dream was to have his own dairy farm. And so when he was able to realize that dream, that was a huge step in the early 60s, and we could have milking machines. But my mother still had to work alongside my father. I came from a large family. And my older sister and I had to stay in the house and watch our younger siblings and prepare the meals. And my mother was right out there in the barn working alongside my father, and it was her job. My father did most of the handling of the cows as far as bringing them in and out of the barn, washing their udders, you know, getting them set up in the stalls. And my mother had to carry, you know, remove the large milking machine from the cow's udder and carry it quite a ways to the cooling tank, and so that was her primary job, and then maintain that cooling room where you store the milk until it's picked up by the big milk truck every other day. But I would say the biggest help as far as modernization was the pipeline system. Once that came to be a possibility for our family, I would say that was the biggest help of all, was for the milk to be able to be transported directly from that milking machine into the milk tank. And I also heard the interviewees' earlier comments about not being cool to grow up on a farm, and it definitely wasn't. I mean, I growing up in the 60s and early 70s. I mean, we could not do things after school like our friends did. We had to ride the bus to school, ride the bus home after school. Our parents just could not be bothered. They did not have time to let us do extracurricular activities. So,
and Shirley, did you, when you were growing up and you were in the house doing the housework and taking care of your siblings and preparing meals, did you wish that you were more involved with the other chores on the farm?
In a way, although my father was such a hard worker, he was a workaholic and had a temper. I would have liked to have had a little more variety. I confess I didn't. I sometimes resented having to be confined mainly to the house and being responsible for my younger siblings, because I had a younger sister with Down syndrome who required a lot of supervision, and she used to run away a lot, just wander off. And so those of us, my sister and I, who were delegated to the house and taking care of the younger siblings, we had our hands full.
Yeah, you're certainly no stranger to hard work.
So,
Shirley,
thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us. You can join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. And there was so much difference in so many of the different families that you profiled. I mean, there were families like Shirley's where the girls didn't go outside and work, and then there were other families where the girls did go outside. And it seems like those women seem to have, this is just an observation from what I picked up, fonder memories of growing up on the farm. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the things that Shirley points out that I think is important to bring up is that whether a farm girl, a farm daughter was inside or outside, one of the great sort of joys of growing up on a working farm, you know, sort of self-sustaining working farm, which had become so rare even in Iowa, is that you feel like you're part of something larger. You know, I could think of one of my interviewees from the Mount Vernon area who made that point, that you really feel like you're a part of a larger operation that you would be missed. You know, even in Shirley's case, you know, it certainly sounds like it wasn't easy. And yet imagine her family without her, you know. So she was instrumental, it sounds like.
Dee is on the line next from Fairfield, and Dee is one of the people that you talked to for the book. Hi, Dee.
Oh, no, I said I am his book.
Oh, you are his book. All right, I misunderstood. Tell me your story.
I'm not in his book.
Okay.
You
could have been. All right, what's your story?
Well, I was born in 53, and when I was in seventh grade, my dad put me on a two-row Ford cultivator. Went two rounds with me, and he said, "You're good." And he said, "I'm going to go do chores, so come find me if you have any questions." From that point on, I worked on the farm in the field and would much rather do that instead of the housework inside. And so as we went through the years, my brother farmed, and then he passed suddenly a few years ago, and then my dad, and so my husband and I have moved back to the area to help hold the farm together so that at some point one of the grandkids hopefully will come back and farm.
Oh, wow. So you find yourself where you started.
Yeah, and it's great because it's a great life, and certainly America needs farmers. And I think one of the key points when all the changes in the 60s and 70s is the importance of off-farm income for many farmers also.
Yeah.
Because many of them, you'll notice one of them went to work and then they come home and work also.
Well, Dee, thank you so much for sharing your experience. And that is an interesting thing. I mean, when it suddenly changed the dynamic, and of course, so many conveniences came around as well, that a woman on the farm didn't necessarily have to spend her entire life doing housework and preparing meals. There were other options, as there were for women in town as well. And many women on the farm then became providers as well, and they got other jobs.
Yeah, big change in off-the-farm income, you know, for sure. I was just looking at the stats last night, and The median farm income for 2012 nationally, this is according to the USDA, get this, negative $2,799, negative median farm income. Now, median off-farm income average around $55,229 for farm households. So, you know, I wrote down a quote from the USDA that most farm households earn all their income from off-farm sources. Shocking. You know, it gets at
it
the way that we misperceive, you know, contemporary agriculture in Iowa and how we define a farmer.
And it also speaks to, I'm sure, a lot of questions that go through farmers' minds about continuing.
Absolutely. And the sacrifices they make, sounds like Dee is one of those to keep it going.
We'll continue our conversation in a moment. I'm talking with Zachary Michael Jack. He's the author most recently of The Midwest Farmer's Daughter in Search of an American Icon. Coming up in just a moment, we're also going to be joined by Cheryl Tevis of Iowa Women in Agriculture and Denise O'Brien, founder of the Women Food and Agriculture Network. We also want to hear your stories at 866-780-9100, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. And with me today is Zachary Michael Jack. He's the author of The Midwest Farmer's Daughter in Search of an American Icon. We're talking this hour about the many different roles of women on the farm. And we're going to take a leap. We've talked a lot about the 60s and the 70s. We're going to jump right into the present day now with two new guests. Cheryl Tevis is on the line from Iowa Women in Agriculture. She's on the board of directors. Hello, Cheryl.
Hello. Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here today. And you have a lot of experience on farms and working on a farm in your life and also working with other farmers.
Yes. I grew up on a farm. I'm a farmer's daughter. I come from a long line of farmer's daughters. And also, I'm the wife of a farmer. We have two daughters who are raised on the farm. I also wrote for a magazine called Farm Wife News, and I'm a current editor at Successful Farming Magazine, as well as being involved in Iowa Women in Agriculture. So, yes, I've had a lot of different perspectives and a lot of personal experience.
You've filled every role, it sounds like.
Many of them, anyhow. Yes.
Wonderful. And I also want to welcome Denise O'Brien. She is the founder of Women, Food, and Agriculture Network. Hello, Denise.
Good morning, Charity and Zachary. It's wonderful to be here.
Hi, Denise.
And Denise, you also have diverse experience farming. Can you give me a little thumbnail of your background?
Sure. And I did not grow up a farmer's daughter. I grew up in town and sort of like in the 60s when, the farmers were all those kind of guys out there. And never thought I'd marry a farmer in the 1970s. And so my farming started about 40 years ago when I married a farmer. And I set out to be a farmer, not a farmer's wife. So, and then through the years, I noticed that women really, as an outside observer of women in agriculture coming into it from town, being a town girl, I noticed that women really did play a major role in the farm, but really were never really recognized for it, which eventually in the 90s led me to found the organization Women, Food, and Agriculture Network.
Well, I was just going to ask you that. As someone who tried to enter into farming as a partner, as a farmer yourself, I would guess that a lot of the stereotypes and assumptions that people had about farm wives really meant that you ran into a lot of perhaps frustrating situations where people didn't think of you as a farmer.
Well, it has over the years, and it continues to, you know, from time to time. But for the most part, again, growing up in town and coming through the feminist movement, and that I, when I determined to be a farmer, I was determined to be a farmer. So those things kind of, you know, just kind of washed off my back mostly.
Cheryl, as you grew up on a farm and have farmed yourself and observed farmers for all of these years, when you look at the transitions that have taken place, and as I mentioned, we kind of skipped over the 80s and the 90s, which were very significant.
Very
significant years in farming. But it strikes me that in some ways, the breakdown of our traditional farming structure and the loss of a lot of family farms in Iowa, in some ways that seems to have opened up opportunities for women in farming. How do you see it, Cheryl?
Well, I grew up on a farm, and it was taken for granted that I would go to college. And at that point in my life, I had not planned to marry a farmer either. I had seen a lot of the hard work and a lot of the uncertainties of Mother Nature. Like Denise, I had not planned to marry a farmer. But after I did, I saw that women really farm families are very diverse. My mother herself did not work outside of the farmhouse that much, except in the gardens and the orchards. But, you know, my mother-in-law has done every job that any of the guys have ever done on the farm. My husband's sister is a farmer. And so, you know, I think the 1980s, as was mentioned earlier here, had a very significant impact on farm women and their opportunities. Of course, during the farm crisis, they took jobs off the farm. You know, and we're supplying maybe the household income as well as maybe the health insurance for the family.
They probably saved a lot of farms in
the
1980s.
Yes, that's right. You know, and I do think that, yes, there are more opportunities than ever today. And we see that. I have noticed a lot of women who have graduated from college in a business with a business background or some type of a degree, perhaps even an agronomy. And other areas have come back after they marry a farmer, and work off the farm for a certain number of years, and then they're kind of drafted to come back to work on the farm full time to put some of those new skills to work. And we also see this with women that are getting involved in. And Denise can speak to this more with direct agriculture, you know, and marketing, and women using those communication skills and relationship building skills in those arenas.
Well, and Denise, tell us a little bit about some of the women that you see coming into farming today, because there has been a shift in what kind of farming people seem to be interested in getting into.
Definitely. And it's been interesting over the years that I've been working in agriculture and with women in agriculture. I've noticed as I've traveled the country and been on speaking tours like on college campuses and that I would identify myself as a farmer, young women would come up to me and say, "Oh, you say you're a farmer. I'm so glad to hear that. I want to be a farmer." And what was very interesting to hear was that many of these women were urban women and had studied environmental sciences, they had environmental studies. They gotten an apprenticeship on a small farm and fell in love with the soil and the type of work that farming is, and determined to be a farmer. And a great many of those young women are now farmers, and it's in demographics show that women going into agriculture are going in at a faster pace than men now, and that they're doing smaller farms with livestock. And a lot of women mostly are growing food for their local communities.
And Zachary, you write about sort of the changing narrative of farming. And in the 1980s with the farm crisis and into the 90s, you write about how there was sort of a shift in how farm life was portrayed. And 1,000 acres is a great example of that. There was this grim portrayal of farm life.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have a lot of respect for Jane Smiley as a writer. She can write circles around me, that's for sure. But I think that book in many ways did a lot of damage to the reputation of women on the farm. You know, it was there's so many traumas and tragedies put into that one book that dark turn, that it's sort of the representations, literary representations of the farm in the 1980s in particular, had the effect of, you know, scaring many people off of the farm. And this is cyclical, you know, in American history that rural life you know, usually it's maybe once a generation is portrayed as being, you know, dangerous or lonely or, you know, otherwise undesirable.
But there has been, again, a shift in not necessarily literature so much, but in many popular books lately, many popular nonfiction books. There are so many people who are writing about farming now in a very different light.
Yeah, and I think, again, the demographic there is interesting because it is largely more urban and suburban, and it's oftentimes it's folks who decide that, you know, for a year in their life they're going to farm, or it's maybe they're trying farming for the first time from middle age, or maybe they've been away from the farm for 30 or 40 or 50 years and they're writing a memoir from an urban setting. So I think what we're, you know, the sort of long-standing perspective that someone like Denise has, or kind of a native, the native perspective, particularly from those farm girls and women of the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, who lived it, who aren't just returning to it, is something we need more of.
Cheryl and Denise, I'd love to get both of your insight on this, because we've been through a back to the land movement before, really in the 1970s. That was very popular in culture at the moment. And a lot of the people who went back to the land in the 1970s didn't stay on the land. But we seem to be in one of those cycles again, where a lot of people are attempting to go back to the land. Does this feel different, Denise?
Oh, I think so. I think in a way there's very much there's similarities, but on the other hand, I think it's with it in the 70s, and I was a part of that culture. It was to escape. It was to escape a lot of things, you know, just the politics of the time, the Vietnam War, the, you know, those sort of things. And then I think the shift is that people feel there's a strong feeling towards commitment of the land and changing, you know, the way that some of the land is used. And I can't really describe it or put a finger on it, but it's definitely there are changes. And I think it has to do some of it with Earth Day. And that, of course, was the factor that pushed people into the back to land movement then. But there, and actually it runs the whole range. I just recently saw a conference that's going to be about canning and pickling and preservation and water purification, and it's also about how to do concealed guns, you know, how to handle concealed weapons. And so that's a whole range of survivalists to back to the land, and I want to be in touch with nature.
Interesting. Cheryl, what are your observations?
Well, we do see some of that. I live in rural Boo County, and we do see some new individuals and residents in our rural community, and some of them have you know, work in Ames and want to commute. They like to hunt. Perhaps they raise a garden. Perhaps they also have some chickens and maybe horses for their children, and they want their children to experience those chores. So we do see some of that. We also see some conventional farmers who the next generation is coming back to the farm and perhaps building a high tunnel and growing produce there because their parents are not ready to retire yet, and they're looking for another alternative, and perhaps they're close enough to an urban area where they can market that, or perhaps even a camp that's nearby that in the summer would buy their produce. So we are seeing some of that. And I do think, you know, obviously gas prices are a factor, you know, if there's commuting involved to an off-farm job. So, you know, there is that to take into consideration as well, you know. But I think there is a real interest in food today and what types of food that families are consuming. And I think they like to, a lot of people do, if they're not raising it themselves, they want to be close to farmers markets and be able to access fresh food and vegetables.
Let's go back to the phones. Gloria is on the line in Williamsburg. Hi, Gloria.
Good morning.
Hi, and you grew up on a farm.
I did. I grew up on a farm in Nebraska, and I was the only girl of four brothers. And so, like some of your guests before, I certainly was in the house, and my brothers were out on the farm. My chores consisted of feeding bucket calves and collecting eggs. But three of my brothers stayed on the farm. My oldest brother is in agribusiness. And as they have continued to grow the farm to be able to support the families, their daughters now are starting to come back. And that, I'm surprised at the joy for myself. I'm happy for them, but the joy for myself in the strong connection that I still feel to that place. And yet I moved away so many years ago.
Interesting. And when you watch your nieces work on the farm, what do you see?
Oh, they do the books. They work the large equipment. They feed the cattle. They do the whole gamut.
Do you think that they see a future on the farm?
Oh yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, they're moving there and considering that. And my brothers are apprenticing them in. Although they've also been apprenticed in for the last, you know, their whole lives.
Gloria, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you. I've really appreciated the program.
Thanks a lot. And we have just a couple of minutes left. And Zachary, I'll start with you. You explored the past. You explored the past from many different perspectives. But now let's look into the future. What do you see as the future of women on the farm?
Great question. I mean, one thing that we have to bring up, I know the USDA projects that in the next 20 years, 70% of American farmland is going to change hands. 70%. So if you think about agriculture as sort of crucial to what we are as a country and the providing food as crucial to our survival, that's a big number, and it's daunting. And it's something that every Iowa farm family ought to give very careful consideration to, and I know most of them are. Looking forward, I mean, certainly there's a move towards smaller farms. The vast majority of which women-owned farms, you know, would gross less than $10,000. So again, the off-the-farm income is going to be crucial. And I think this trend towards returning to the land will continue, but I think it will be different than the back-to-the-land movements that we've seen before, or the kind of native-grown female farmers of the, you know, the 40s, 50s, 60s.
Cheryl, what do you see in the future for women in farming?
Well, farm women will continue to be involved as farm partners and, of course, mothers and homemakers and working off farm, working on farm as business partners. They also have a really significant role these days as promoters of agriculture and using a lot of the social media skills to blog and to be involved in Facebook to explain modern agriculture to a non-farm public. And I think also women really have been shown through research that they play a major role in the success of the transition from one generation to the next. And whether that generation, you know, is male or female, they are critical to that. So in niche farming and direct marketing and as farmland owners who perhaps live maybe quite distant from the farm, there's a role there. And also in agribusiness, we see a lot of farmers' daughters ending up in agribusiness roles.
Thank you so much for being here today, Cheryl.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Cheryl Tevis of Iowa Women in Agriculture. She's also an editor of Successful Farming Magazine. And Denise, very briefly, you get the last word. What do you see as the future for women in farming?
Well, I think it's a very bright future. I think, and it's really, where we need to really make inroads are into boards of directors. Women need to be on the boards of co-ops. They need to be on the boards of banks, of various places where there's money controlled and decisions are made. And as long as women get into farming, that's good, but we also need to be at the decision-making table, and that's a really important piece.
Denise, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Denise O'Brien, founder of the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network, and Zachary Michael Jack, thank you so much.
You bet, Charity.
Zachary Michael Jack is the author of The Midwest Farmer's Daughter, In Search of an American Icon. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Rick Fredrickson in Des Moines. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, I'll talk with Jessica Fellows about the world of Downton Abbey. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.